Welcome to Healthcare and Hire, a podcast for healthcare professionals and aspiring healthcare executives looking for information, association, and inspiration from higher-level leaders across the healthcare industry. I'm Iqbal Acha, career consultant, healthcare recruiter, and registered pharmacist. Every week, I sit down to interview healthcare executives, clinical leaders, medical entrepreneurs, and industry experts to learn how they got to where they are today, what they see as the future of healthcare, and what they're doing to make healthcare more accessible, affordable, and effective. Let's find out more about today's guest. Lou D'Souza is the Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Cerner Corporation. She heads their largest physician group and leads a team responsible for helping health organizations leverage their EHR and health IT to improve patient care, clinician engagement, and clinical outcomes. Lou joined Cerner in 2011. And has held various leadership roles within the organization, including physician executive, senior director, and chief medical informatics officer. Prior to this, she served as a pediatric emergency physician at both Brandon Regional Hospital and Lakeland Regional Medical Center, as well as serving as a director of pediatric emergency for Team Health. Lou received her doctorate degree in medicine from Wright State University and is a fellow of the American Medical Informatics Association. She is passionate about advancing healthcare information systems and applying learnings from different healthcare systems around the globe. Hello, Dr. D'Souza. Welcome to the Healthcare and Hire podcast.
Hello. How are you, Iqbal?
I am wonderful. It is a pleasure to see you and hear you.
Same here. And Iqbal, really pleasure being here with you today. And I feel honored that you asked me to join. I've listened to several of your podcasts and your guests are really well accomplished and impressive individuals. So I humbly feel good and very good company here. And, you know, I also wanted to thank you for creating this platform, because it's very important for young people and young professionals that perhaps have aspirations to get to higher leadership positions, and this will inspire them. And I hope that shed some of the fears that go along with those decisions. I certainly had a lot of those. So I think I've always appreciated hearing from others how they got there.
I'm so excited you feel that way, Dr. D'Souza. And is it okay if I call you Lou?
Please call me Lou, yes.
So Lou, I think that we're going to have a phenomenal deep dive into a lot of these aspects, because you are right. There is a misperception, confusion, where people just can't see what the future looks like. And having guests like you that have really paved the path for what success is and talking about it, it's going to be a huge boon. I know that there are some people that are listening to this podcast that are extremely familiar with you and the great work that you and Cerner do. There is, however, a population that's probably meeting you for the first time. Let's take this opportunity and have you properly introduce yourself. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, what your role is, and how do you help take healthcare to a higher level?
Thank you again. So my story is that I started in training in pediatrics, and how I got to pediatrics is a whole different funny story that I'll tell you over real coffee someday. But initially, I thought that I was going to be a general pediatrician taking care of kids in underserved communities. But as I went through my training, I felt the most affinity and also had the most fun taking care of acute illness as a pediatric hospitalist and pediatric emergency medicine doctor. No offense to the word fun. You know, we all have to derive pleasure from our work, and I really enjoy being challenged by acuity in the healthcare setting. And to me, it was very meaningful to connect with the children and try to make them laugh and try to remove as much of their fears and pain as I could, but also have those open and candid conversations with parents so that they're informed about the care and help make decisions with the care, because medicine is not black and white and they have choices to make. So this was really important to me. The other aspect that I connected with was really understanding the importance of the care team. I see too many of my physician colleagues being single players that are used to making decisions, but to me, medicine was about the care team and making decisions together. That's how I enjoyed practicing. And that care team that surrounded the patient and actually had a lot more touch points and a lot more effect on that patient's outcome than even myself. And through that process, also started taking interest in the technologies that we engaged in that care delivery and seeing their potentials to, you know, become part of the care team, whether to help us standardize the care that we provided, improve that patient safety, and definitely removing those redundancies that we see in our work everywhere. I also had this, you know, future forward thoughts at the time of the role the technology could play in preventing and predicting illness. So it's doing that today, but that dates me to my 20 plus years ago that when I started. So really, to me, moving into health informatics or medical informatics was about two things. It was this desire to do more for patients at a broader level. And then secondly, it helped me chase my inner kid's love for sci-fi and this dream of a futuristic healthcare delivery systems. If you are Star Trek fans out there, you know, Dr. McCoy and his little gizmo that detected everything that was wrong with you. I always loved that. So I am a chief medical officer at Cerner and a vice president, and I lead a group of physicians here in the United States that are responsible for helping organizations leverage this health technology that they've acquired to achieve these strategic goals, to focus on that better care quality and clinical engagement, but especially today, helping them with better usability and efficiency to drive the technology related burden that we see. Because, you know, as I took more and more roles in informatics and different organizations I worked in, and definitely since coming to Cerner and working with a lot of organizations across the United States and a few outside of the US, you can't help but to notice the variability with which these technologies are engaged, how they're leveraged, how they're used. And that really plays a huge role on the well-being of the clinicians and that the experience that they have with this technology. So our industry, you know, is still a long way before this technology is considered a meaningful member of that care team. And also it's a long way from achieving the promise that was made back in the days of meaningful use when we all started racing towards becoming digitized of better and cheaper and patient-centered and equitable and joyful care. You know, we're not there yet. So there's a lot of work to be done. And those are the items that our team really focuses on. We also bring this collective level of clinical experience and general healthcare acumen to Cerner, not just as physicians, but we have a huge body of clinicians, pharmacists, allied health professionals, and we contribute to Cerner developing clinically focused, clinically oriented products and services and content for our clinicians. The other aspect of my job that I really enjoy is really serving my team. So as a CMO, it's my job to help their career and leadership development. And I specifically like growing and mentoring clinicians that we serve. So the physicians that we take care of outside of Cerner is really important to help them develop their voice so that they can have an impact on how this technology is delivered so that it's of assistance to them and not a hindrance. So those are the things that are important to us. I belong to a really great group of leaders at Cerner, and together we develop and we drive strategies that hopefully better position Cerner in order to support its clients.
I love how you encapsulated so many incredible aspects of not just the organization, but also the mission of what it is trying to do. And you actually did something which is rare. And I think that is really helping to frame the timelines of where digitization and information technology is. you pointed this out very nicely. You said, like, you know, hey, for those of us that love Star Wars and Star Trek, you know, like this idea of a utopian society or a utopian world where like everything is at your fingertips, like we are not there, like not even halfway there. And there's still so much work to be done in this process. But I think that sometimes when I speak with individuals, like, oh, you know, we've made so many leaps and bounds, we probably have. But I know I love the way that you see things, because it's very important to understand that there's more work to be done. For the listeners that are tuning in and understanding a little bit about, you know, what you've just shared, you know, many people are familiar with Cerner, and I'm sure most of my listeners have actually worked with some of your software platforms and products already. But just for more context, I think it's kind of important to help, you know, reframe what Cerner is, how it came to be, and really where it stands in terms of industry positioning. So this is an organization that began like 40 years ago. It has multiple products, and it's not just the products that you offer, but the fact that it's available at about 27,000 different facilities around the world. You know, that really makes it an integral component of how healthcare professionals not just access data, but gather information to be able to make critical decisions that are life-saving as well. I think what's also interesting is that as Cerner being ranked number 490 on the Fortune 500, you guys have been able to really make some great strides in a variety of ways. Again, not just working with your clients and with your customers, but from a larger perspective, with 29,000 employees, your organization actually was awarded 12 different awards last year alone. Like, I was reading this and I was amazed. Like, Fortune magazine had identified you as like one of the top employers, top workplaces for women, top employer for diversity. But you've also taken great strides into being able to give back to the community. So if I'm not mistaken, you also won the Helen Darling Award for an excellence in healthcare value and just a variety of things. So when you say, you know, you've heard some of my past episodes and you are impressed with the guests, let me just tell you, I am super impressed with you and your company as well. We have only scratched the surface in terms of the great works that you have done personally. And I think one of the reasons why I wanted you to be on the show so badly is because, you know, in our personal conversation prior to this, like, you shared with me some of the steps that you had to take, not by choice, but by necessity, that really changed the way that you know, approached medical care, informatics, and then really placing patients at the forefront. So I'm just super honored to have you on the show, Lou. To be really honest with you, that is exactly where I'm at.
Thank you. I mean, it's an incredible company, and I'm really proud to work in a company that values partnerships and philanthropy. And, you know, daily, it might be hard for people to believe when you're a Fortune 500 company what I'm about to say, but in our day-to-day talk and the things that we present and the way we communicate, we don't use the word sell. We use the word serve. And this is really what drives us as a company. I also, you know, I wasn't planning for this, but when you were talking about the awards last year, we have done incredible work to help solve the problem of DEI. It's very tough for us in organizations that are in healthcare and in tech combined to attract, you know, a diverse population to come and work. And I, you know, as a woman who is also gay, who is also a foreigner, who's been at Cerner for 10 years, I just have to say this is not new work. You know, when I started at Cerner 10 years ago, our chief people person was an outwardly gay woman, and at one point our president was a gay man, and we have been awarded year over year awards with HR, HRC. And so it's been really great to see and work in a place where people can be themselves and where their ideas, their perspectives are always welcome and requested, to the point that sometimes the demand is a little bit greater than the time you have to give. But it is very important for us on our day-to-day to work around these topics.
Lou, thank you for that insight. Again, these are things that most people just don't, they cannot imagine that those types of environments exist. And to have somebody that is, you know, at the level that you're at to come in and talk about what's important to the company is really critical. So we're going to tap into that a little bit more. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, what's happening today at Cerner. Everyone is aware that, you know, it was recently acquired by Oracle, and that's exciting and scary because now you have so many new opportunities, new resources, and probably like, you know, new initiatives. initiatives that you'll all be considering. Let me ask you this question in two ways. One, as a Cerner associate, is there something that you and your company, maybe even your department, have identified as a problem that Cerner is well positioned to address today? Or is there something that Cerner has done very recently that you're very proud of and you'd want to be able to share with the community that's listening? Because again, many times, you know, when people think about an electronic health records organization or a healthcare technology, it's usually not as interactive or engaging, right? It's just, let's take the data, let's analyze the data, and then give guidelines to other people to work with it. And that's just like that, just very high level, 30,000 foot view. But your organization does meaningful work. And that's where I want you to be able to share with me, like, what has Cerner done that's really, you know, meaningful and has had great impact in a community or even for an industry as a whole?
You know, it's a very large company, as you pointed out. Dabbles into just about every aspect of healthcare delivery. A lot of people don't even know that we've owned our own clinics so that we can deliver care and we can understand better healthcare by being also delivery system of healthcare. We've had our own employee services business. We've had our own health plan. We do anything to automate hospitals and clinics, from laboratory to pharmacy to devices to connecting to the outside, you know, wearable world, and so on and so on. So it's hard to pick a few things, but most recently, I think health equity has been very highly in our minds. And so I wanted to bring two great examples that I believe Cerner is creating an impact in this space that it has been much needed. Because of this immense work that health tech or health IT has done to digitize the health record, we now have this incredible amount of data, right? And so it's a different place now than we were 10 years ago. Again, hard for users to believe because you don't want them to see how the sausage is made in the background. And what healthcare is suffering from is similar to, again, we're going to date ourselves here, Iqbal, to when the ATM card could only work in that particular bank, or, you know, in that you had to look at your chip in the back of the card.
And Maestro versus Cirrus, right?
Exactly. And that's where we are today. And the reason for that is just standardization. There's been a lack of standards for a lot of data pieces in healthcare, and we've been solving for that. So it's not very sexy work, but it needed to be done to lay that groundwork, you know, the piping around how information moves and then how it's leveraged. And in order for us to do that, these systems need to understand what each data piece is. So now that we are in a better place of having, you know, millions of digitized records and having this data available to us, we have this incredible opportunity to start solving very specific problems like bridging gaps in health equity. As you know, 80% of what impacts the patient's healthcare has nothing to do with you or me delivering traditional care in a hospital or clinic setting. It has to do with where they live and what they eat and their socioeconomic status and all of these different social drivers of health. And so we're really not touching or impacting the long-term health of populations as a care delivery system today until we really start leveraging this data. And it's not just because it's the moral thing to do. You know, we know from a very practical perspective that this health inequity leads to poor outcomes. It costs us more unnecessary utilization. And then when you take things like a pandemic happening, which, wow, nobody expected that, right? But it did. It just really showed us just the impact of this disparity and that can have in populations. Increased, you know, mortality, increased morbidity, increased hospitalization. A lot of it driven by the social determinants of health. So at Cerner, we're doing two main things in this space that I'm very proud of. One is in the care delivery side. So now that we have this digitized clinical record, we can also utilize publicly available record and geospatial mapping, for instance. We bring all of those analytics to our clients, and they can start mapping out where vulnerability lives in communities. And once you find that vulnerability, you can then work with community programming to, you know, develop very specific interventions. So without divulging clients' names, we have this really great client in South Carolina, for instance, They were trying to find out and how to help a very specific community. It was African-American communities or patients that were showing to have a higher prevalence of unmanaged diabetes and hypertension. So utilizing this type of data in geospatial mapping, they found that these patients clustered around an African-American church, which is very important to their daily lives. And it's a place where they go for advice. So they partnered with the church community leaders to help deliver that care. They found nurses inside of that congregation that were doing the screenings and the outreaches. And now they have just an incredible result of 50% more of that population already has those conditions under control, under better control. They're managing those conditions. And so that just tells us that we can't do this alone. You know, we in health tech, in health delivery period, have always had this paternalistic approach to healthcare delivery, telling patients, we know what you need, we're going to tell you what to do. And that just doesn't work. And it certainly does not work for the generations that we're serving today. So we need different approaches. And in order to do that, we need different perspectives and different partnerships. We can also do this type of work at the individual level by doing very specific evidence-based screenings that informs us, you know, of the risks for an individual. We can do risk modeling, and then we can develop programs around these individuals with community-based referrals. Again, community being very important to help us advance, you know, the health of these individuals. That is work that we're doing for that care delivery side. And again, we can't do it alone. You have to engage a multitude of stakeholders with a lot of different perspectives. Community partnership is extremely important. And then there are other companies that are doing this better than us in certain spaces. So it's important to create those partnerships that lead to the success we're looking for. So I always say to people, you know, when it comes to utilizing tech to solve a use case, you need to be humble. You have to have a lot of humble inquiry and understand what the problem is, and then leverage a lot of different perspectives to go and solve those things together. The other aspect of this data, the power of this data, is how we are revolutionizing clinical research. And I don't use the word revolutionizing lightly. I truly believe that this is going to be a huge game changer for all of us in our future, because we're changing the way clinical research is being done such that it's being done faster and that it's representing the population much better than it was before. So at Cerner, we stood up a nationwide network of very diverse health systems. We're talking about big academic centers and all the way to critical access care hospitals and a multitude of clinics. They're almost in every state. We're not quite in every state, but we're almost there. To date, we have 96 million de-identified patients in this database. So it's de-identified, it's very safe, and it's free. It's free, and it comes with cloud computing capabilities, because again, when you are dealing with this big data, it doesn't mean anything unless you can do something with it. And that requires a lot of computing power, AI, machine learning, et cetera. And so what this data is doing is helping to feed a richer pool of patients that represent diseases in the areas where they live into clinical research and clinical trials. So for instance, biggest problem that we have in research and equity today is that the majority of clinical trials are done in academic medical centers, but the statistics will tell you that about 70% of people live more than 2 hours away from academic medical centers. So they're not really represented in this research, right? Further than that, when you look at disparate populations, low socioeconomic status, you know, language barriers, you name it, they have a hard time getting to those clinical trials, or maybe not quite to the right understanding, not to the right providers, not in the right locations. When you look at vulnerable populations like children, less than 20% of clinical trials and research represents them. And even for cancer, which is so well studied and has such a broad reach, only 3% of cancer patients actually make it to trials. I think you know all of that because of, you know, your background in pharmacy, but I certainly, when we started down this pathway, was very surprised by these statistics. So what this all highlights is this need to expand the geographic reach of these clinical trials in order to more accurately represent the disease incidence, the population, the pathophysiology, and certainly those social determinants of health. So it's been a really fun and really fulfilling journey for us as Cerner to stand this up and to watch our client organizations do research at such an incredible pace. We're talking about starting a project to putting that back into clinical workflows and getting good outcomes in less than a year, as opposed to the previous at least 7 years to get there. Traditional research. I'll pause there so that you can go, ooh, ah.
Well, my jaw is still on the floor at this point. What you've just shared with me is science fiction in a way. Like, none of these things sound real. What I love in this conversation are several aspects. Cerner's humility in these projects is not about dominance. It's not about, here's our goal and what we're going to accomplish. It is about a spirit of community and collaboration that is being fostered and led and participated. But I think what amazes me is the speed and pace of the results. A year to be able to have that kind of impact is, it just sounds so far-fetched. But here you are making that happen. And I think the altruism and the spirit of humanity that is coming out of this conversation is really integral. You touched on several things that I want to talk about, and that is the struggle of coming from both a healthcare background as a pharmacist and a talent acquisition HR background, finding diverse talent in this intersection of healthcare and information technology is like finding a needle in a haystack. I know you know that. I know that most of the listeners have at some point had some struggle in being able to find, you know, how do you identify, attract, assess, and acquire that kind of talent? The demographics from my distribution channels do show that there is a proportion of listeners that make up that diverse talent. So if you're wondering where you should be applying to, or, you know, areas of healthcare that are really underserved, here's a wake-up call. Like, take a good listen to this.
And I'm hiring, so.
Beautiful. I mean, I think it's phenomenal that, and certainly we'll be more than happy to be able to add your career's website to the social media post that will go out to promote this episode. So hopefully listeners will be able to either reach out to you directly or just see what's available at Cerner and make that connection. I'm curious to know, you know, you mentioned something earlier in this conversation, which I think is critical for us to explore. And I'm going to do that now rather than later. You know, being a physician, being a healthcare practitioner that has invested really a lot of her time, energy, education, experience in helping a specific patient population, the pediatric population, and moving now into this area where you're able to gather informatics and lead teams to utilize that data and analytics for greater good. You know, you talked about trying to lead other healthcare professionals, and usually sometimes there's a disconnect between healthcare professionals who have gone through this training program and are now operating in a completely different level. Whether that's a leadership level, whether that's, you know, just an opportunity for them to be able to represent their passion, their interests. Sometimes that disconnect really requires strong leadership for them to be encouraging and help them not only find their voice, but to use their voice in boardrooms, at meetings, and really stand up for those that are just underrepresented. As a leader that has these types of professionals, like, that's got to be a pretty significant challenge, right? Like, how do you know? And I'd love to hear your story, because I know that, you know, very rarely do I find guests on my show that had an easy path to doing that. It's not like they just woke up and says, hey, here's what I firmly believe in, and I'm going to kick down these doors and, you know, talk to the C-suite level so that they understand what's happening. Like, there were a lot of struggles and a lot of challenges. And now here you are leading a team of professionals that have the right attitude and the right mindset, but sometimes they lack the courage or they lack the vision. How do you foster that in physicians and other healthcare professionals to find that voice and to be able to use it for the greater good?
Oh, what a fantastic question. And it's part of, you know, certainly our passion to help providers or practitioners find that voice. You know, I have to say that, and perhaps people don't understand this, that traditional medical training here in the United States and really in majority of countries does not provide physicians that next level of training to be administrators, to help lead people to understand how to manage and really develop these critical skills. You know, people call them soft skills, but, you know, soft is a terrible term because they're so essential to really learn how to have that executive presence and utilize your voice in a constructive way, and to not just constantly oppose, but also learn how to propose instead and think of innovative, you know, ways to simplify and work together. Also, even how to work together. Doctors are very singular in their work in a lot of times. They're used to taking charge, making risky decisions. It's what we're trying to do, right? To act and to solve problems in the moment. But in order to get to this next level, you need to learn to listen and learn to collaborate and learn to be humble. I'm going to use that word a lot because it's served me really well in my role. And so at Cerner, we find this to be so important that we've actually developed a training program. It's more like a workshop. It's facilitated by myself and a team of other physicians in my group. And it was not started by me. It was started years ago by my predecessors. And it's been really fantastic because it allows us to connect with these leaders in a different level. And they get to sit in the same room and understand that their problems are really similar. You know, they all suffer from the same problems in their organizations. And the biggest problem is that the majority of our work is about change management. It's about people and processes, and it's not about the technology. So a lot of physicians and medical informatics, they go about getting the right training to be a medical informaticist. They understand systems like nobody's business. They can translate and communicate between the clinicians and the IT teams really well. They will go 10 clicks above my knowledge level as far as the depth of their technical knowledge. But what I find is that I don't really need that so much, Iqbal. What I need is to help organizations develop clinically integrated governance models that allow people to make decisions down at the point of care where decisions need to be made so that they have shared accountability for what they're working on and what they're trying to drive as far as outcomes. Nobody wants to be told what to do and how to do it. And we in healthcare have traditionally done that to some of the highest educated, highest paid members of that clinical care, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, as opposed to bringing them in and sitting them at the table with us and designing these things together and helping them help us solve these problems. So we work really hard to empower clinicians to do that. And I might have gotten lost in my answer to you. I think at one point you might have asked me, what does it take to prepare for this role? And, you know, I'm not going to tell you guys what it took me because I can honestly say I would not hire myself today at the level that I was when I started at Cerner because I had very little training. I had a lot of street know-how. You know, I got in there and I worked with teams and I took on IT roles just out of curiosity and this desire to try to help design them to help me better. But I never had any formal training. Today, there is tons of formal training out there that physicians can have, same with nurses and pharmacists to approach this health informatics career, ranging from various certifications that you can get to full fellowships that are available today for doctors. I think health management is a really great path to take as well if you want to be in an administrative position. And I find that if you're interested in informatics, the American Medical Informatics Association is a great home for this information and for these health informatics professionals. It has really great sources on the top, like the types of jobs that are out there, the types of training that are out there, and it helps match people with mentors so that they can understand what it takes. But, you know, as I have gone down this career path at Cerner, it's been 10 and a half years now, and I'm in a position of help train and develop and hire new clinicians, there are two things that are the most important for me that I look for in people. And one is really these leadership skills. It's easy to teach people the technical side. It's a lot harder to teach them how to be a leader. So especially around change management and having that open growth mentality, this desire to engage others, to learn from them as much as to teach them, and to help manage people through change, because change in healthcare is very stressful. Day to day, they're dealing with life-changing events, making really hard decisions, and then we're introducing a lot of technological change that impacts them, and that's really hard to mitigate. So that's our biggest role. It's really, again, not about the technology. It's really about the people and the processes.
So Lou, that helps me ask the next question, right? Because, you know, especially in the last 2 years, I mean, healthcare has always been stressful. Healthcare has always had like a high workload, you know, sometimes underutilization in certain areas and certain facilities. But, you know, as we've seen in the last 2 years with the pandemic, the great resignation, the great reshuffle, whatever you want to call it, healthcare has been hit the hardest with either attrition, of course, resignations in that space. But in addition to that, just the complete departure from the profession and from the industry. And I think it's critical that we talk about it because, you know, these are individuals that have gone through extensive training and have gone through, you know, programs both nationally and internationally for them to become the best of the best. And after a certain point in time, they hit a wall, right? This burnout that we're seeing, it's not relegated to a particular niche of healthcare. It's almost across the board. How do you try and help individuals that are facing this decision that maybe they've come to you at some point in a conversation and they said, Lou, I just can't do this anymore. I mean, this is just overwhelming for me. It's heartbreaking for me to be a part of this environment. And I just don't know if it's within me. I mean, working either with individuals or organizations to mitigate this crisis has got to be, you know, one of the priorities that you have. And I'm curious to know, how do you help people and organizations overcome this bridge and help them, support them so that they can continue with their mission or at least find replacements in a way that makes sense?
Well, so I wasn't quite prepared for it. And so many thoughts are going through my head here because it is a very complex topic. You know, it is multifactorial and it's been around for a very long time. And as you look all the way back to when burnout, you know, started hitting high levels in the medical literature, for instance, it was way before EMRs came. There has been different, you know, drivers of it along the way. And certainly since meaningful use rates to adopt technology. Technology has hit higher levels of burnout for these clinicians. And you're right, it's across the globe. It is not a doctor problem. It's for every individual that provides healthcare. And it's also very important to remember, and I just want to quote a couple of numbers, and these might not be the latest, Iqbal, but 44 to 55% on average is the burnout rate for most clinicians across the United States. Global space is very similar to that. Nurses, doctors fall within that range. And the general population is a lot lower than that, anywhere between 11 to 23%. The other big difference here is that healthcare professionals already have a much higher level of resiliency than the general population. And that seems to be lost on people because when you start talking about clinician burnout, they start prescribing yoga and resiliency training and mindfulness. And nothing will drive a physician or nurse even crazier than if you tell me that I need to make time to go do some yoga or, you know, have some meditation and meaningful time. Those things are important, don't take me wrong, but they don't have time for that right now. And it's not addressing the systemic issues of it. So it's really a systemic problem. It has to do a lot with the bureaucracy, the environments that they focus in. It has to do with them not feeling like they are true collaborators anymore, that their word is being taken for granted or that it's not at the table, that they are not shared, like share accountable stakeholders in the decisions that are being made in health organizations. So there are so many different levels to it that it is a very complex problem. But the great news that I tell people, and I don't have a magic bullet either, there are programs, many frameworks out there to just pick one and start using it, start tackling it. Don't overthink it. Don't have analysis paralysis of what is going to be better for me. Your organization just needs you to start now. You know, it needs you to pick a plan, you know, and start working on it. And you'll see that once you start to really focus on it, you're going to make progress. And when you start to really engage your population to understand what they need, you're going to start making progress. So there are a lot of ways and a lot of good things that can be done today. From a technology perspective, what the data tells us is that EHRs are anywhere between 20 to 30% responsible for burnout today. And we see that in various shapes, whether it's research that is specific to EHR satisfaction, or it's research that is just asking the, you know, questions around burnout, and EHRs will hit usually like number three or five of the drivers of burnout today. And what the data also tells us is that efficiency is the number one correlator to that burnout. So what we need to do is really find ways to drive those efficiencies and decrease that burden, you know, mostly administrative burden that lives on the shoulders of our clinicians today, and engage them in more meaningful work, ensuring that everybody is working at the top of their licensure. We see that care delivery models have really shifted away from care teams. And I honestly don't know why. Somehow computers got in the middle of people having conversations and sitting down and making clinical plans together and dividing and conquering the work. You know, there is this misinterpretation that because I'm the doctor, I have to get a medical history. I have to get a medication history. I have to get everything and I have to do it all. And that's not the case. And that is not what our nursing counterparts want either. They want to participate in the care. So we've had this shift that we need the pendulum to start swinging back again. But also from health administrators and especially from regulators, we need to find better ways to remove, you know, this administrative burden that lies on everybody's shoulders today, because we need them to stay. And they are considering other things to do. I did, you know. At the end of the day, when you're being measured by how many CT scans you ordered in the ER, how many patients you admitted to the hospital, you know, did you admit them fast enough? Did you turn around fast enough? Nobody cares if you sat down with that patient and actually had a conversation and cried with them and told them that you're going to help find answers and then took the extra 30 minutes to go, you know, research that for them. That is not, in healthcare today, the model does not support that. And that is what we need to strive for, is spending more time with our patients. So we need to find every possible way to get that back for our clinicians, because we can't afford to lose any more of them.
I'm so touched by your response, because, you know, the whole time that you were sharing that with me, I just kept thinking about my father. So my father is 80. He will be 85 in June. He is a geriatric infectious disease internal medicine specialist, has been practicing for 50 plus years. And, you know, despite all of the technology that's been introduced over the last 2-3 decades, he continues to practice today the way that you saw Marcus Welby do, like the sit down 1 hour, 2 hour, you know, let me understand what's going on socially, economically, spiritually. Like, when I think of like what a consummate physician should be, is somebody who you have described. And that is really having an ability and an opportunity to show empathy, really understand the individual patient, right? And not be bogged down by check this box, make sure that you've completed these forms, and hey, let's increase the rate of, you know, tests that are being ordered, or, you know, measurable data, because that's a component. It's not the central focus. I appreciate you sharing that, Lou. That means a lot. And again, it also reinforces the love I have for my dad as both a father and a physician.
That's great. And yeah, infectious diseases is like detective work. They have to spend time with their patients, and I'm so glad he still does.
Yeah, it's remarkable to see in practice. Lou, when you think about how far healthcare information and medical technology has come thus far. And then you think about where we'll be in 2027, 5 years from now. What else should we be expecting in the next 5 years that is coming down the pike? And how are companies like Cerner preparing to be able to not just address them, but actually be ahead of them or to help support them at a faster pace?
Yeah, I both love and hate this question because in healthcare, unlike a lot of other businesses, when we talk about disruptors, you know, they might take a million years to get there. It's like really, really slow. And really, if it wasn't for the pandemic, we wouldn't be doing as much virtual care as we're doing today, even though we had been talking about it, right, for at least 10 years. And it's driven out of necessity. It's driven out of payment models, unfortunately. Hopefully, what we're going to start seeing is that our delivery care system models are going to be driven by the people, by the patients, by what they want. You know, I like to think of it that maybe in the next 5 years, we're going to have more of care on my own terms. The shift of care delivery models and consumerisms that are going to get us to understand that, that there is the right place for the right patient, for the right condition, for the right type of appointment, instead of trying to fit them into boxes, and which is not working today. So what I'm talking about is, you know, the span from home as a venue of care. This could be what we think of it as traditional telehealth, to digital care monitoring, to all the way to acute care delivery in homes. I have many organizations today that have a hospital at home concept already, which is really fantastic. A lot of it driven out of COVID, and hopefully that won't stop because people don't want to be in the hospital. They want to be home with their care, you know, their loved ones as much as they could possibly be, especially when they are at times in their healthcare journey in which they know they don't have too many more years to do. The last thing you want to do is go spend those years, you know, in the hospital as opposed to with your loved ones. So we're also seeing this expansion of the care team. And again, I love to use that concept, you know, breaking down the walls of what is a care team. These could be wearables, these could be digital and biosensors, you know, that help us understand better and monitoring the patient better so that we're taking action in the right level of care. We have to stop this thought process that something happens, go to the emergency department, and it's not an affordable, sustainable model for anybody, especially now we're seeing that during the pandemic, in which a lot of people haven't even sought care because they were so afraid to go, you know, to an emergency department or to a clinic and afraid to get COVID. So these are going to be very important drivers. And we're seeing very disruptive partnerships already out in the industry. Companies like Teladoc bought Livongo so that they can monitor diabetes better and then treat them virtually. You know, I think one of your guests, Dr. Arwal, talked about Humana expanding home health delivery, right? You didn't think about that from an insurance company in the past. So we're seeing these models, and those are important because if the third party payers are willing to do these models at home for themselves, they're going to recognize the cost savings and then allow the rest of organizations to start following suit. Another interesting one that I recently saw this even last week at one of the health tech conferences, was that Best Buy is entering the health space, utilizing wearables and their Geek Squad to do 24/7, you know, concierge service for people to help them with their wearables, but also help with coaching, health coaching, which is really important. Sometimes patients just need to call somebody and say, how do I take this medication? I don't understand, you know, this discharge form. So that's a whole nother story, right? We need to do better giving them the right instructions. But there is a lot of emergency on different concepts of care that are going to be part of this care team of the future that we haven't really engaged with today. We talked already about social determinants of health and how those are going to be big drivers of how we utilize our resources. Because, you know, just equality is not equity, and we need to find equitable ways to deliver that care. And so analytics and data are really going to help drive the focus there. We have big shifts in technology. You know, AI, for instance, is something that has been gaining momentum for a lot of years. I mean, it's been hard, right, in healthcare to consume because it's so complex and there's a lot of fear of introducing bias into AI and so on and so forth. But we really do need AI to help streamline this ginormous amount of data, patient feedback, medical records that we have today, and then be able to give us insights as to what to do with that. So we're already seeing really good movement and promise of AI in the more operational and transactional aspects of our business. So that's been good. That's going to help decrease some of the timing and the costs and the people that it takes to do these administrative tasks. But AI has also been really great at what I'm thinking of as sensory diagnostics. Sensory meaning visual and hearing. So AI is already showing really great promise in teleradiology and teledermatology, interpreting images for us, interpreting eye exams much better than ophthalmologists and general doctors can when it comes to like looking at your retina and understanding some of the, you know, complex diseases that might be leading to damages there. AI is better than the majority of physicians are. Cardiovascular sounds, for instance, there are several companies that are starting to develop auscultation devices that can be plugged to people's smartphones or to small, you know, affordable devices that then allow the AI to interpret those sounds and say, yes, this is a problem. You know, you might have pneumonia, it's time to go. And they are doing a better job at than me listening to your lungs, Iqbal. So that's really interesting stuff. And I think we're entering this phase of going from AI helping us with predictive care, which means you are an individual, I see your labs, I see your risks, and this is the, you know, predictive aspect, like I could tell you what you're gonna have, to predictive care, which is, you know, Iqbal, 5 years from now, if you keep going the way you're going to have congestive heart failure, so let's do something about it before that even happens. So, you know, I think, I don't know if maybe by 2027, but we are making good strides into that space. So that's going to be really cool. And then also self-diagnostic tools, because you just touched on this. We don't have enough people, right? We don't have enough healthcare providers to provide the care that is needed. And we certainly don't have enough specialists. So talk about pediatric neurologists or subspecialists, right? Those are hard to come by. It takes patients months to get into their clinic to help diagnose autism in a kid. And you and I know that that child has a very short window of opportunity for early intervention if they are to become, you know, a really functional member of society and fulfill the promise of their life and have really great quality of life. So I'm gonna put in a shameless plug for a friend of mine that helped start this company called Cognoa. And what Cognoa is, it's an application that allows a general pediatrician or family practice doctor or even a parent to go in with the AI and interpret the symptoms of the patient and get to a earlier detection of autism so that they can then engage in intervention. And they're also FDA approved for several digital interventions that are cognitive in nature and help these kids significantly. So these are incredible things when you think about changing the lives of people. Interoperability, that's key, right? I want to be in the world that I walk into any hospital or clinic anywhere and I, you know, batch in my health card just like that ATM card or that credit card, and you have all of my information and I don't have to fill out all those forms again, and you know, and I don't have things missing, and I have confidence that you know who I am. So again, not quite sure if 5 years are going to do it, but we're close to getting to this open healthcare operating system in which data is more exchangeable, and that's going to be very important for us. So one thing that I have to say is policy makes this really hard. And, you know, we have to recognize and accept the fact that it's my record and it's my data as an individual. And so if we can get that as a society, I think we're going to bridge that gap a lot faster and make healthcare a lot more tangible for everybody and more affordable. So those are the biggest trends. Oh, and that clinical research one, that's huge. That one is already here today.
These examples that you are providing on this show, Lou, are just mind blowing. Again, very sci-fi, but I also know that, you know, I saw the conference that just took place, and I think at the time of this recording, HIMSS is currently underway as well.
That's right. So they call it Five, which was really fun because it was very vibrant. And it was very exciting to see organizations come together to, you know, to tackle these big risks and checking their egos at the door, which is what we need.
Again, that spirit of collaboration and openness, I think, is remarkable. And, you know, to think that, you know, 10 years ago, we were still doing, I mean, I guess it was like maybe 10 or 15 years ago, we were still like phasing out of dial-up on internet and moving into broadband. And now here we are. I mean, one of my previous guests, I think she worked for Amgen, about, you know, being able to develop biotechnology where you swallow a pill and it literally records all of your senses for the duration while it's in your GI system and your entire, I mean, the way that we are moving forward. So yeah, maybe not 2027, but honestly, I would not be surprised if at least two of the three examples you provided come to fruition. Best Buy is probably one I was not expecting. I was not expecting you to include them as part of this conversation, but that is also very intriguing to see how different companies are able to leverage their resources and their intellectual assets to better humanity and to provide these things. It was really remarkable. Lou, we've talked a lot about the world of healthcare and information technology. We've talked a lot about Cerner. I kind of want to pivot away from all of that and talk more about you. You have a remarkable story. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I invited you to be on the show, because having had an opportunity to see the different experiences that you've had, both personally and professionally, I think really allows people to connect with you and understand and probably relate to some of the challenges you faced. I know that you're from Brazil. I know that, you know, you had a very interesting childhood, which I want you to feel free to talk about. But, you know, from a professional level, like, you've had an opportunity to have both feet in the pediatric treatment world. Like, you served as a director of pediatric emergency department at Team Health. You were also a pediatric emergency department chair at Brandon Regional Hospital, as well as Lakeland Regional Hospital. When you came to Cerner, you were serving as a senior director and a chief medical informatics officer. And now here you are as a vice president and chief medical officer of the organization. As each of these phases have progressed, I know that you have developed new skills, new opportunities, new avenues to add to your repertoire. But, you know, the current role that you're in now is also not just different, but it's novel. And so for you to be able to move into this role, I'm always curious to understand how, when people say yes, what are some of the factors that go into the decision-making process, right? It's not as simple as just saying, well, clearly this is the next rung in the ladder, so I'm going to do it. There's a lot of personal aspects that you have to weigh and you have to decide. You know, I'd love to understand a little bit about your thought process and what were some important factors, again, professionally and personally, that went into the strategic planning of being able to decide, was this the right role for you?
You know, I have to say that I never expected to be where I am today. Certainly was not planned. I am very envious of those individuals that have their life planned out and they say, someday I'm going to be a CMO, someday I'm going to be a CEO. I have friends like that, and it's incredible to watch them accomplish those things. That was never me. I didn't even know I was going to be a physician. But, you know, I consider myself an accidental leader. That's what I call it. You know, it never had formal training in leadership. But I think that I had two really important things going for me that I recommend others to try. And the first one is really just having this growth mindset, in which I believe, and to this day I do, that there is always something to learn from every situation that you're in and from every person that you interact with. And so it was always very important for me to learn from others. And then when these opportunities would arise, to stop and really ask the questions, you know, a lot of questions, to understand, what is the role? Can I really, do I truly have the ability to serve it well? And if not, how do I gain that knowledge and how do I gain that experience? So I never wanted to put myself in a position in which I would fail others. It wasn't about failing myself. It was really about failing the people that I was serving. So I always come into everything in that with that approach of do I have enough to contribute to this so that I can do it justice. And then the second thing is I have this really, well, I call it a good dose of FOMO. My wife would say I just have too much of it, period. Failure of missing out, just this inability to say no to stuff. And so no matter how hesitant I've been to accept the next level of position offered, I was just as hesitant to pass it up, wondering, you know, what if? And so that curiosity about life and work and the curiosity about pushing the boundary of my own abilities has been a big driver for me. And that certainly has come from my upbringing with my mom. So, you know, those to me were the most important things that got me to where I am today. I wish that I had this really eloquent answer to tell you that I, you know, did ABC, MBA this, but I didn't, you know, I didn't. I think those things are very helpful. And I certainly have learned a lot along the way. I've done it poorly and I've done it well. But what I find is as you go along, the more willing you are to learn and to listen and to understand with trying really hard not to insert your bias and your judgment right away, which is a very difficult thing to do. We all do it. The better off I am at getting to the better, you know, to getting to that level that I'm doing well by others.
It's almost serendipitous, right? Sometimes you just find yourself at the right place at the right time, but then you start to, you know, go through the, well, where does this fall for me and what are the priorities and how do you juggle that? You know, you mentioned your wife, you've also mentioned your mom. And, you know, in our previous conversations, we've talked about having a lot of influential people. It sounds like your wife is a very supportive individual. It sounds like your mom was really both supportive and also a strong mentor in many ways. Are those like the two main people that have been a staple in terms of being an influential aspect of your success?
Well, you know, my mother is the reason I'm here to begin with. And I just don't mean, you know, she gave birth to me. I mean, I wouldn't have gone to college if she hadn't pushed me. I was a pretty poor kid growing up and with this wonderful, loving family. But watching a struggle time over time was something I didn't want to do forever. And so I thought school was just a means to a job. And I, you know, I just wanted to go get a job and be more stable and start having, you know, a more normal life. So, but she's a person that no was really only a suggestion, always. Like she never took no for an answer and hope was never a strategy. So she was a single teenage mother with very little support at the time. I mean, I have a very supportive family, but she was in the space where she was more alone. And didn't have very much money, but she was just full of resilience and determination. And so those are the things that you can really help instill in a kid, I think, and teach them how to do stuff. You know, I'm a pediatrician that will be the first to tell you, you can start teaching kids from a very, very early age to become independent and to do things for themselves and to learn. You know, never underestimate their ability to learn complicated stuff. Always give them, you know, the benefit of the doubt and you'll see how far you can go. And so that was the case to us. It was a matter of need. I needed to learn how to take care of myself through her experiences. But I watched this person reinvent herself so many times. And she was at one point a teacher. She was a seamstress. She was a businesswoman. She learned how to do house remodeling and then run that business. And then she learned how to be a naturopath and started delivering care in a different way. And I watched her learn all these different careers from scratch, a person who had never gone to college. So, you know, I had a lot more going for me as far as resources. I couldn't possibly say no to stuff and I couldn't possibly not try my best. And so you follow the examples of the ones around you. She was my biggest impact. On the career side, you know, Neil Patterson was one of the three founding fathers of Cerner, and all of the three were just brilliant geniuses. Paul Gorup is this incredible genius, and I love learning from him and absorbing ideas from him. But Neil comes to mind because he was this innovator and visionary that always challenged the status quo. But he also never wasted a crisis or a personal tragedy. So he always shared with us in the company that a lot of the complex healthcare problems he was trying to solve or wanted us to solve, they were affecting his family. They were affecting his friends. You know, when he set us off to go solve interoperability, I want to stress that because it is a much more complex problem to have these disparate systems talk to one another than the easier path that some of our competitors have taken of just having same EMR talk to each other. So he set off to solve this problem because his wife was dealing with cancer and she was carrying around carts and carts of health record with her, right? Because she needed to go to different providers in different states, different locations, and they didn't have access to her data. So she was the person who had to procure and carry that data and express that data and ensure that they had the right data to take care of her so that her care didn't start from scratch every time she went somewhere else. And it was, you know, Jeannie's experience that lived inside of us every day that we tackle this issue. And so to have a person like that, that has this ability to paint this vision for you, make it very personal, and then challenge you every minute of the day to go solve it, it was very inspirational.
Wow. I had never heard that story before. And to hear you share that, it really redefines how organizations devise their mission. And the fact that he was able to see that and you were able to be a part of that story, that's really powerful. Lou, thank you for revealing that with us. Lou, let me go back. As you were starting to define yourself in a professional sense, I think, you know, one of the reasons I bring this up is because many of us that are healthcare professionals, and we've talked about this earlier in this episode, is that, you know, we go through this process that's been kind of created for you. Go and, you know, go matriculate at this particular healthcare discipline. You'll learn all these things. When you come out, you'll be able to be a practitioner and you'll be fine. And, you know, all your problems will be solved. But in reality, when you came out and when you started interacting with patients and other providers and payers, you realize that the theory that you were taught doesn't always apply to practice. So I'm curious to know, was there a life lesson that you learned early on in your professional career that changed the way that you approach people, processes, or problems?
Boy, I don't know if I can put my finger on like a particular, you know, event, but definitely a lesson that I learned really early on, especially because I was, when I came to the States at the age of 16, I could already speak English. It was part of my education in Portugal. They focus very much in Europe to teach kids a second language, sometimes a third. So I was very grateful to have that. And I grew up with some Canadian friends and I learned English with playing with them as well. So language was a barrier to an extent as far as never having gone to an English speaking school, you know, never having a critical thinking in English or a higher, you know, educational level. It was more conversational and it was very kid-like English. And, you know, to be completely transparent, that's actually what my Portuguese is now. I can go and have a conversation with healthcare leaders, but it's not going to sound as eloquent as this. And so I had to learn that when I came and I started college. And so I always felt just a little bit behind the curveball. I was not, you know, I didn't get the highest grades. I mean, and you know, as a physician, I still got majority of A's. GPA was pretty decent, but you know, you're dealing with a different pool of people. And so there are much higher achievers all the way around me. So I think that resourcefulness, you know, was very important for me to learn how to leverage those around me, learn how to study in groups with them, which is not something I ever knew how to do, that I needed to be with others and have them help me to learn better, you know, so that collaboration became really important. Having this commitment to delivery was really important, meaning stick to your word, do what you say you're going to do, work really hard to get there, engage others to help you. You never have to do it alone, but you have to make it. Like, you need to get there and you need to deliver it and, you know, follow through with your commitments. And then think of different innovative approaches to how, you know, how you work. Because we're trained in very classical ways of thinking. So when you don't have that as a basis, you know, you really need to have different ways to learn and to work in order to get there. So I think that what I would say, and I used to say this all the time to our residents, it's not how smart you are, it's how quickly you can get the answer.
Oh, I like that.
And that's much more important than IQ. I will stand by that. That is much more important for people to have resourcefulness versus just having a high IQ.
Lou, you have so many, I mean, you've done so much throughout your career. You have, I'm sure, much more to do, and you will be very, very successful at it. When you take a look back at your legacy so far, is there a moment or an achievement that you think back and think, you know, that's something that of all the things that I've ever been involved with or helped to create or do anything with, I'm really proud of that?
Iqbal, I think of myself as a connector, and that my impact is more at that micro level, helping organizations connect, you know, their resources or their technology to the problems they want to solve and their goals, or connecting people with their work and helping them find meaning, or connecting people with one another so that they can have, you know, ways to solve a problem better together. That's, I think, my contribution overall. It's not a big, you know, huge thing that I went and did. Everything that I do, we work in groups and we help each other. I would say in Cerner, what I'm really proud of is that we have been working really hard to elevate the clinician's voice in technology so that these systems are built to support our clinical workflows, and instead of trying to change how we work. So that's really important. And it's really the only way that we're going to get this technology to become that user-friendly part of the care team that, you know, we as technology company have to stop and listen and learn. And that is, believe it or not, a really big culture shift for technology companies, because they're used to coming in there with big, bright ideas and engineers to solve problems, right? And it's not working all that well in healthcare every time. So being that connector of people, bringing these disparate groups together in ways that they can listen and learn to each other, I think is my contribution.
Lou, is there a book on your nightstand or a person that you follow regularly, maybe on social media, that you consistently are able to derive value from, or maybe you recommend to others on your team from a personal enrichment, individual growth perspective?
Yeah, you know, I have read quite a bit of leadership books. I'm sure you have as well. And there's some incredible ones out there. But the last one I read, which is not all that new, it was just new to me, was Brené Brown's Dare to Lead. I love that book. I really connected and I felt like she was writing it for me. She talks about how you can be successful as a leader, showing vulnerability and not being afraid to rumble. That's the word that she uses that I love, is having these open, deep and hard conversations with people in order to solve real problems and get there together. And I think, you know, I've never really sat down to really think about what type of leader I am. I think it's an exercise that we should all do. It's important to understand yourself and understand how you can best contribute. But she helped me understand that I feel the most comfortable when I'm serving others. And in order to do that, you have to show this humbleness and vulnerability. So I'm trying to learn from her on how to do that.
I think you are the second person that I've spoken with very recently that quoted that book by that author. So I will have to probably add that to my list of Audible books. I do not read.
You send me your address and I'll send you a copy.
Lou, we've talked about so many different aspects of you, your company, your professional journey, you as an individual. They've all been amazing. You know, when you think about a final piece of advice to share with the listeners today in terms of how to help them advance their own career, again, many of the things you've already shared are actionable items that I know they've already written down and they'll continue to start acting upon. Is there one thing that maybe you would say is that you would give as a final piece of advice, not just to the listeners, but maybe to your younger self? If you could go back in time and say, Lou, don't worry, everything is going to be okay. As long as you do this, what would that one piece of advice be?
It's emotional intelligence, actually. And it's something that I really enjoy facilitating in our workshop for physician leaders. I learned immensely from this topic, and I wish that I had started this, you know, journey with emotional intelligence all the way back to, you know, when I was 16 and first arrived and didn't know exactly where I was going to go into. It is absolutely the most powerful tool that we can develop to move ahead in our careers. It's been shown over and again that people that have high emotional intelligence are the ones that are being promoted. They're getting paid higher. They are happier in their jobs. They feel more fulfilled because they understand themselves better and they are chasing those aspirations that fit, you know, that have the right fit for them. But they're also, they learn how to understand others and have healthy relationships with other people of various interests. You know, they person with high emotional intelligence understands that you need to have conversations with all types of people, whether you like them or not, because there's so much to learn from those individuals. And it's, I always say this to my colleagues, the moment that you realize you need a friend, that you need someone to support you, let's say in your organization, you know, at college, in your career, in your life, the moment you realize that it's too late, what you need to do instead is work on these relationships and build that bank. And then you've got this following behind you and you have people that are willing to stand up and will do whatever it takes with you. So in order to do that, you need to work on emotional intelligence.
Lou, you've been a spectacular guest. Thank you so much for joining me on the Healthcare and Hire podcast today. I'm blown away by your insights and your stories of leadership and just your stories of personal growth. I am super excited to see how the rest of the year goes for you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you continue to take healthcare to a higher level.
Thank you, Iqbal. What a pleasure it was to meet with you. And I really enjoy the questions, and the exercise is very important for everyone to go through and think about these things for themselves. And again, really appreciate this platform to help other professionals achieve what they want to do with their lives.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Healthcare and Hire podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow and subscribe for more. I'm your host, Iqbal Acha, and I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what you thought about this episode or my show in general. Also, visit me at www.achainternational.com to learn more about how I help healthcare professionals and healthcare leaders advance their career, build a better brand, and create a leadership legacy. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, let's keep working to take healthcare to a higher level.